Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, and today we're going to be speaking with Paul Signolfi. He is the Executive Director and Chair of the Workers' Compensation Board here in the great state of Maine. And we're going to be talking to him about, well, a lot of things. Because, you know, Paul, to be honest with you, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir.
I'm not sure a lot of people really know that the Workers' Compensation Board is completely separate from the Maine Department of Labor.
That's true. It's a freestanding agency. In many jurisdictions, workers' compensation is subsumed under their Department of Labor. In some jurisdictions, it's under the Department of the Insurance Bureau. But in Maine, it's a freestanding agency and has been a freestanding agency almost since its inception.
So what are the key areas? I mean, people know what workers' comp is, right? I mean, they know that employers say, we have to have that, and we have to have, you know, insurance and different things like that. What does the board oversee?
The Workers' Compensation Board is responsible for overseeing all work-related injuries in the state of Maine where there's an employer and employee relationship. So, for example, if you were self-employed and you were injured, if you're a tradesperson and you were self-employed and you were injured entirely on your own, we do not track that because there's no workers' compensation relationship there. On the other hand, if you're injured while working for an employer, we oversee all aspects of that injury. We know when it happened. We know where it happened. We know the employer is obligated to report information to us, like how much you were earning at the time of the injury. We track your medical care subsequent to the injury, and then we track when you return to work.
So you work close in hand with OSHA.
They share information with us, and we share information with them, yes.
Okay. So when an individual, or an employer, I should say, when an employer has an accident, let's start with the basics. They have an accident, someone gets hurt.
Yes.
What are the official things that they're supposed to do?
If the employee is injured and they lose time from work, they're obligated to, if they know about the injury, so there's reciprocal responsibilities between an employer and employee. If they know about the injury because they've observed it, they're obligated to file a first report of injury and let the board know that there's an injury. On the other hand, if they didn't observe it and the employee reports the injury, they're obligated to report that as well to the Workers' Compensation Board. They're also obligated to tell us how much the employee was earning. There's a form that they fill out called a wage statement. In addition to the wage statement, they're also obligated to file a statement of benefits. So if they have benefits in addition to their wages, we want to know about that as well. Ultimately, that information is put together so that we are aware that the employee is being properly compensated if there's lost time.
So do you work directly with insurance agencies as well to get that information?
We work directly with insurance carriers, yes.
Okay. So,
Or self-insured employers.
How about self-insured employers?
We're an unusual state, David, in that typically, if you look at the states across the United States, about 18 to 21% of the employers in those states are self-insured. In Maine, it's 42%. So we track self-insurance as well.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that there's such a high level of self-insured?
Because we had a major, major crisis in workers' compensation in 1992. And subsequent to the crisis, and during the crisis, I believe that there was only one or two insurance companies that were writing insurance. Subsequent to the crisis, a number of large employers became self-insured, and a number of groups got together, became self-insurance trusts. So that's why, primarily because of the crisis in 92. Those days are behind us.
Well, that's a good thing, right? That's not a bad thing.
That's a very good thing.
Is there a difference when it comes to unionized versus non-union reporting?
No, not at all.
Okay, so
all employees are treated the same.
All employees are treated the same. Okay, good. Just making sure. I thought that was the case, but thought we'd ask. Again, today, the goal here, ladies and gentlemen, is to really provide some education to employers to make sure you're doing it right, reporting correctly, and that we actually know what they're doing up there in,
yes.
in Augusta, right? I think it's good education for everyone.
We think we're doing it right.
Well, you know, we'll ask people to comment after. We'll make that happen. All right, so I know that there are a lot of different classifications of workers. And this is an area I know that is certainly becoming more and more, if you want to call it, hot and heavy with the changes that are happening federally in terms of classification of workers. In short, who is an employee and who's an independent contractor in your mind?
That's a very interesting question, and let me preface my question by telling you where we are in the state of Maine with regard to who's an independent contractor. When the governor came to office, one of the things he made as a priority was the idea that we would have a single definition in the state of Maine who was an independent contractor. Believe it or not, before his administration, there were 11 separate definitions of who is an independent contractor. And what would happen to businesses is that depending on what state agency was involved and which part of which state agency was involved, someone could be found to be an independent contractor by certain state agencies, and others would find the same person under the same factual circumstances to be found to be an employee. So in the legislature 2 years ago, we put together a definitive definition of who is an independent contractor. And basically, if you are working for another for wages, under our new law, there is a presumption that you are an employee, unless and until you can meet the tests that we have in our statute. And the tests really look at a variety of different things, namely control, who controls the work that you do. That is, do you control your own work or is someone telling you what to do? Is there an opportunity for a profit or loss? An employee typically does not share the opportunity to have a profit and also doesn't share the risk of having a loss. But somebody who's independently contracted runs the risk of either losing money or making money on a job. Does the person make themselves available to a client population, or do they simply work for one person? For example, we're at the station here. Do you just work for the station, or you're able to work for a number of different people doing the same kind of work? And then it's a five-part conjunctive test and seven-part disjunctive test that we have. So it's actually a pretty good definition. What's happened since that definition has come into being is that I've had an opportunity to speak at some national meetings about it, and several states have sought out our help in putting together a definition of who's an independent contractor.
So when an employer is questioning it in terms of making sure they get it right, should they call your department? Should they call the Bureau of Labor Standards? Should they call the Department of Labor? Who should they be contacting?
They could call any one of those because we're all now using the same definition. So if they called us, we would direct them to where in Title 39A they could find the definition for workers' compensation purposes. We could also direct them in Title 26, which is the labor standards provisions of our state laws, where they could find exactly the same definition.
Is there a different definition, just to stay with this for a minute, between the state definition and the federal definition?
Yes.
And so how do, of course there is. I would have it no other way. And so how does that get reconciled in the state?
Well, let me tell you, there was a directive issued by a gentleman by the name of David Wheel, the application of the Fair Labor Standard Act, on July 15th of this past year, where he talked about their independent contractor test. And I was pleasantly surprised after reading it. It's a five-page document. After reading it, that what we're doing in Maine today is closely paralleled with what they're doing in the federal government, at least with regard to the Fair Labor Standard Act. So I don't know how you reconcile if you're dealing with some other federal agency that has a slightly different definition. And I think one of the things that I've learned since coming to state government is how important it is to have simplicity and certainty for employers. And if we could all share the same definition, that would be wonderful.
I think that every employer just went, hallelujah, because that is the biggest challenge, right, is the differencing between the departments, between the agencies, between federal and state and local
yes.
and county and all the different type of officials in terms of what they define anything.
That's true.
Across the board.
When we were putting together the independent contractor definition in the state of Maine, we inquired of the Internal Revenue Service if they would enter into some type of relationship with us, that if we were to find somebody to be either an employee or an independent contractor, whether they would agree to our determination and apply the same standards for them, that agreement we could not reach. So what we did is when we were putting together our definition is there were three lawyers who were involved in that project. I was one of them. We read the appeals court cases where the IRS had commented on who was an independent contractor, and we gleaned out of those cases language that we ultimately put into our own definition. The thinking was, thinking at the time was, that if we do that and if they look at the same set of facts, they likely would come up with the same interpretation. And we've not seen a case on that issue yet, but my guess is that we're pretty close to their definition now.
One of the challenges, of course, of independent contractors is they don't fall under the category of getting workers' compensation because they're not employees. How big an issue is this? I mean, if we're talking in the state of Maine, are there any statistics that support that it's 2% of the population, 50% of the population? How big of a real issue is this?
I really don't know. People who truly function as independent contractors have no obligation to report to us that they're out there, and as a result, we really can't track them. I can tell you, however, when I first took this job, so I was a lawyer in private practice for years.
You're a recovering lawyer.
Some people say that. But I came to this position, and I did a bunch of speaking engagements. And invariably during the course of those engagements, people would say to me, is there fraud in workers' compensation? Particularly if I was speaking to employer groups. And my response was a standard, yes, there is. And their eyes would light up, and they'd say, we knew those employees were taking advantage. But then I would follow up my comment by saying, but it's not what you think. The real fraud in workers' compensation nationally, and Maine is not immune from what's going on nationally, is that employers are misclassifying people who work for them, and they're calling them independent contractors as opposed to employees. The reason for doing so is that in their overhead, these employees cost them about 30% less than somebody for whom they're paying all the benefits. And so if I were an employer in the state of Maine and I were competing against somebody who called everybody an independent contractor, I would certainly be very upset about the fact that it was not a level playing field.
So when, you know, if they do fit the definition and they are truly an independent contractor, mm-hmm. Is there anything wrong with that?
No, absolutely nothing. God bless them. Let me further explain, though. Let's assume for purposes of this discussion that I'm still out practicing law, and I set up my own shop, and I practice entirely by myself. But I know that during the course of my practice, I'm going to be traveling. I'm going to be traveling to different courthouses. I'm going to be traveling to different registry of deeds and things like that. And I'm aware that traveling in Maine is dangerous in the winter. I can purchase a workers' compensation policy for myself and essentially be covered in the same way as somebody who is an employee of someone else. So independent contractors can purchase policies for themselves if they choose to.
Do all carriers cover that, or is that through the state, or how does that?
No, private carriers would cover that.
Interesting. And would that be then tracked?
Are you learning something, David?
I am. I must confess, you know, I was not aware that owners could buy or purchase workers' compensation in terms of that. That's a surprise to me. So, we've already learned something here today.
That's true.
It's very nice having you on the show. Have a good day now. No, just kidding. And how common is that? Is that really known out there?
I think it's known. I don't think it's all that common. I think people do it who are in high-risk industries and run the risk of being injured, and they look for ways to support their families if they're.
So it's really like buying a disability policy, correct?
A limited disability policy.
Limited disability policy, yeah.
Because it only applies to injuries that happen at work and because of work.
Well, some owners might say that they're working 24 hours a day, so, you know, and they may be truly working 24 hours a day in terms of the ownership side.
I'm sure that's true.
So in terms of, that's interesting because that's a disability policy or a version of the disability policy in terms of, okay. All right, that makes sense to me in terms of putting that through. All right, so we've talked a little bit about classifications and misclassifications of workers. Is there anything else that employers should know in this category that they should be aware of or make sure that they do?
One thing they should be aware of is that we audit employers. We look for people who are not complying with the law by purchasing policies. And there are fairly substantial fines if we discover that you have not purchased a policy to cover your employees. How do we audit? We do random audits on payroll. In some instances, we share information with Revenue Services and with the Department of Labor. And so we have a division within our agency that is charged just with doing that. After an audit, we will try to negotiate something with that employer. Our principal concern is providing coverage for your employees. And if somebody admits that they were wrong and they provide coverage, we're prepared to negotiate what the penalties would be. If, on the other hand, they fight with us about that, there's a petitioning process that we use within our agency where we try a case in front of one of our hearing officers on whether or not there should have been insurance and whether or not the payroll was a certain amount so that we could calculate what the penalty would be.
Well, no, I think it's one of the things I've learned, if nothing else, from talking with a lot of the individuals that work for the DOL and so forth, is that there is this attitude of trying to work with the employer rather than just finding them and making it all punitive, correct?
Yes.
Education is important.
Let me give you an example. There was a fellow who called me several weeks ago who said, I have a small trucking company. What he meant was he had a truck. He was doing well enough to buy another truck. He bought another truck and put his brother on that second truck and didn't realize his brother then became an employee, and therefore he was obligated to provide workers' compensation coverage. In some jurisdictions, but not in Maine, if it's a relative, you don't have to have workers' compensation coverage. In our state, it matters not whether you're related or not related. If somebody's working for you, they're your employee.
Interesting. We're talking with Paul Signolfi, Executive Director, Chair of Workers' Compensation Board. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
We're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB and presented by CMAKorea.com. Today we're talking with Paul Signolfi. He is the Executive Director and Chair of the Workers' Compensation Board here in the state of Maine. And we're talking with him about things that employers should know, may know, or may not know, and that how you can stay current and compliant. Paul, we talked a lot about, in the last segment, the classification and misclassification of workers and why and who is the independent contractor. What happened in the workers' compensation at the legislature during the last legislative session?
There were a number of bills that were introduced that in large part were attempts to give certain segments of our working population a leg up in workers' compensation. What I mean by that is they tried to create presumptions in our law that if a certain set of circumstances arose, it was presumed it was work-related. Most of those bills did not go through very successfully. There was, however, a bill that went through extending workers' compensation benefits for certain employees of the state fire marshal's office who contract cancers. Initially, that bill I did not look very favorably on it because I didn't think there was much science to support it. What happened then is Professional Firefighters Association and the Fire Marshal's Office produced research that demonstrated that people who work as fire marshal investigators get exposed to chemicals. Either they breathe them in or they touch them in their investigations. And as a result, there's a statistically higher incidence of certain cancers. That bill was voted out of committee, ought to pass. It was It was passed in the legislature. The governor vetoed it, but his veto was overturned. So that bill came through. There was a second bill that had some concern. I had concern about, and that is it was a bill to really tinker with some of the ways the Workers' Compensation Board operates. So they didn't affect benefits at all. They didn't affect substantive rights. But what they did do is they changed the way the board would do things. And that bill was dealt with in committee. It was amended, and it came out making four changes for our agency. And a fifth part of the bill was something that I was actually looking for. Want me to tell you what the changes
are?
Please,
I was just going to say, you took the words out of my mouth. Give me the changes.
We have an obligation in the state of Maine, as I was telling you earlier. If an employer has somebody who's injured, they're obligated to file wage statements. That provision came into our Workers' Compensation Act in 1916, and they were obligated to fill them out on a weekly basis. 10 years ago, our legislature changed the law that you no longer have to pay employees weekly. You can pay them at intervals other than a weekly. And now approximately 90% of people who work in the state of Maine do not get paid weekly, but rather get paid every other week. Some get paid monthly, but most people get paid every other week. So here we were requiring people to fill out forms on a weekly basis when they were paying their employees every other week. This law changed so that they now are reporting wages based on the intervals that people actually get paid. The second part of the bill is that there's a Maine Insurance Guarantee Fund. So if an employer goes bankrupt, or an insurance company goes bankrupt, I should say, the Maine Insurance Guarantee Fund ends up taking over those files. The Maine Insurance Guarantee Fund is an agency that infrequently deals with our cases. What this bill required that we do is we train their staff every time they got a new bankrupt to make sure that they're complying with the provisions of our Workers' Compensation Act. We have independent medical examiners who work for us. These are physicians that we're required by law to maintain on a panel. They do evaluations of injured workers. If someone requests that take place, we assign them. The parties requesting it have no control over who's assigned. They function independently. The bill now requires that we keep certain data relative to our 312 examiners. And so we will be tracking things that are easily quantifiable: how many 312 exams are requested, who requests them, how quickly they're assigned, how quickly they issue their reports, and those kinds of things that are quantifiable. The fourth thing we did is that we used to make the employers and insurers keep track of injured workers who were missing time but not losing wages because of doctor's appointments. And we did that for a couple of reasons, and I don't want to wander too deeply into the weeds. This law has changed that, and we now will obligate them to keep track of time up until the time that injured workers are out for 14 days. They miss time for 14 days, but they don't lose wages during those 14 days. And the final thing was something that I wanted. We have people who hear cases for us. They're essentially our judges. They're called hearing officers. Across the country, for the most part, they're called administrative law judges. There was a directive that came out from Medicare in May of 2014 that said that if there's a workers' compensation case and a judge makes a determination that the nature and scope of the injury is this, an ACL anterior cruciate ligament tear or a carpal tunnel syndrome or a herniated disc, if the case is settled and the person then starts collecting Medicare will take whatever the judge says is the injury and will pay for all other medical benefits.
That's a big deal.
My concern became, knowing the federal government, what if the decision was made by a hearing officer as opposed to a judge? Would they accept that opinion the same way they would accept the judge's opinion? So when the legislature was talking about making some changes, I asked, could we change the title of the people who decide cases? They're not going to be doing anything differently. They're not going to get paid differently. They're just going to enjoy the title that most other jurisdictions presently have for people who do that kind of work. And you know what? They are judges. They go through the process of evaluating and deciding cases like a judge in district court would or a superior court would. So we've changed their titles.
So you got some things done in this legislative session.
We got good things done.
Yeah, you know, that's all in positive. That's all positive.
I think so.
Is there anything that's coming up in the next session in terms of, you know, which what we would say would be nice to have for the next session or carried over maybe from the last session?
Interesting that you ask. I'm working with a task force right now, and I've been working with them actually for a considerable period of time to introduce coverage for uninsured injured workers. So if somebody were working for an employer, the employer misclassified them and called them an independent contractor, if they were injured, they would probably not have a right to collect any benefits because many of those employers simply don't have the assets personally to satisfy any type of judgment against them. In 46 states in the union, in the United States, they have provisions in their Workers' Compensation Act, and they're written a myriad of different ways, but they provide coverage for the uninsured injured worker. A group of us within my agency and some people consulting with us have put together a statutory scheme that I'm hoping somebody takes at the beginning of the next session and moves into legislation. A statutory scheme that would cover the uninsured injured worker. And there's two parts of the bill that I think will cover the universe of people who are out there working or are misclassified.
We're talking with Paul Signolfi, Executive Director of the Workers' Compensation Board, and we're talking about things you should know when it comes to workers' compensation for employers and what's happening in the legislative session. You know, it's interesting. There are a lot of projects that are going on for workers' compensation. What are some of the projects you're working on today?
Well, one of them is the that bill to cover uninsured injured
yep.
workers. I'm also working with a small group of medical professionals to deal with what I perceive to be the opioid problem in workers' compensation in the state of Maine. Once again, we are not immune from what's going on nationally. And in talking with physicians in the state, and from talking with others, there's an opioid problem fairly pervasive in our society. Workers' compensation is not immune from that. So I'm working with a group of medical professionals at this point to try to get a handle on how big the problem is, if there is in fact a problem, and what we might be able to do with the problem. I'm going to be reintroducing into my task force people who are non-medical people and people who are dealing with who are medical but deal with other kinds of problems. My thinking is, in looking at, Texas did this a long time ago, 5 years ago. Washington State did something on this 3 years ago. Ohio did something last year, and other states across the country are doing things with this problem. My thinking is, if we can get the medical professionals on board to help us figure out the scope and nature of the problem and figure out what to do with the problem, then we can introduce the non-medical people or the extended medical providers so that we can figure out how to deal with it. My sense is if you reduce the number of opioids that are available to people, they're still going to have chronic pain. They're still going to have problems. And what we will likely do is have other kinds of therapies step in to fill the gap. So we'll have cognitive behavioral therapy. We'll probably likely have chiropractic treatment. We'll likely have physical therapy. We'll likely have osteopathic manipulation. We'll likely have other modalities that help people address chronic pain problems. So the opioid treatment would go down, and these other treatments would likely increase.
Do you think that there is an acceptance by the medical community, an acceptance by mainstream in terms of using alternative methods?
I think there is. I think if you were to ask me that same question 3 years ago, I would have said, I'm not so sure. Kevin Flanagan, who is the medical director of the Maine Department of Health and Human Services, has done a great deal of work in this area. And I have to he's leaving, unfortunately. I have to commend him that he has cracked the ice, so to speak, and he's gotten the medical community, all of whom deal with Medicaid patients, aware that this is a problem in that population. Let's think about alternatives. And I think he's done a masterful job, and we hope to follow his footsteps.
We've had a lot of talk in the last couple of years about medical marijuana and its potential municipal value or problems at the workforce. It certainly comes up when it comes to workers' compensation. What is the department's stand on it? Where do you see it happening in the future, especially if it, as appears in 2016, will become recreational?
Medical marijuana is an issue that my colleagues from across the country have been watching carefully, as have I. As you know, medical marijuana was allowed in the state of Maine beginning in 2009. It's presently allowed. We have had three cases on medical marijuana decided by our hearing officers. The board doesn't have a formal position, and the board typically doesn't take formal positions on things like this. We're essentially an apolitical regulatory agency. But I can tell you of the three cases that have been decided, two of them were decided in favor of the injured employees. That is, that they will be reimbursed for their expenses associated with medical marijuana, and there was one that was denied. If you read the decisions carefully, and I think they were all well written, if you read the decisions carefully, the hearing officers who decided them thought about the medical condition for which the employee was being treated and looked at the statutory provision allowing for medical marijuana and made sure that the medical condition fit nicely within the statutory provision that allows for medical marijuana. But it's a very interesting issue. Let me tell you why it's of interest. When someone settles a workers' compensation case and they're going to be likely collecting Medicare at some point in time, there's an obligation to do something that's called a Medicare set-aside trust. And in order to do that, what you typically do is retain the services of an expert to look at what the future medicals are going to be, how much the physician's bills are going to be, the hospital bills are going to be, and the pharmaceuticals. I heard a story the other day where somebody 4 years ago had a Medicare set-aside trust evaluated. So they had somebody evaluated for putting together a trust. Ultimately, the trust wasn't put together because the opioid expenses of that trust were going to be about $206,000 going forward for the rest of this gentleman's life. The deal wasn't made. They didn't settle the case. They're now thinking about settling again. They've had another Medicare set-aside evaluation done. This person is no longer taking opioids at all. He's using medical marijuana. The future medicals in that case are now $26,000. So it's gone from $206,000 to $26,000. So on an economic basis, it makes for it's pretty compelling. It makes for carriers to be interested in because it could conceivably be a money saver.
It changes the conversation, doesn't it?
It really changes the conversation. Yeah. The other thing it does, too, is that people think about medical marijuana, and they think that the only way that people take medical marijuana is they smoke what we would refer to back in the 60s as a joint. That's not the way many people take it. They may vape it with one of these vapors. Some of them use an oil. Some of them have edibles. So there's a number of different ways which arguably are less physically harmful than taking opioids for prolonged periods of time. Not arguably. I think it's pretty clear that they're less physically harmful.
And that is a shift in policy, is it not?
It is.
And do you see that only moving forward stronger in terms of the overall policy making?
Let me tell you my concern. And I've been dealing with a physician who writes orders for medical marijuana on a fairly regular basis. Because it's illegal on a federal level, there's very few people who are studying it. There's very little science, so to speak. There's a whole body of science that came out in the 1990s, and there's not been a lot in recent times. I think in order to deal with the issue of whether medical marijuana makes sense in the medical marketplace, it would make sense to have the research to support. Get the FDA in there to look at it and see what the upsides or downsides. We simply don't know enough. I remember years ago, in a former life, I worked as a psychologist, and I can remember seeing the movie Reefer Madness. And I think I compare the movie Reefer Madness to what's going on today. I think we're obligated as state regulators to be open-minded about this. Is it a good thing? I don't know. It looks like, at least what I'm hearing from the medical professionals, that there are people who are taking massive doses of narcotics who are no longer doing that. That in and of itself seems to be a good thing. But I don't know enough.
We're talking with Paul Signolfi. He is the Executive Director and Chair of the Workers' Compensation Board. And we will be right back on News Talk WLLB.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com. We're having a great conversation, Paul, aren't we today?
I think so.
We're talking about workers' compensation. That's what we're talking about, ladies
that
and gentlemen.
True.
Employers need to remember very much what you need to do. You need to be compliant, and we need to make it happen. So, you know, in the last segment, we talked a little bit about the legislature. We talked a little bit about some of the things that are happening having to do with the task force and what the projects you're working on. You talked a little bit about that Maine is not immune to national trends. What are some of the other national trends out there that we should be aware of, things that employers should think about in terms of understanding their employer base and so forth of what's happening?
I think nationally, workers' compensation is going through an adjustment period. There are 50 workers' compensation systems in the United States that require people to have workers' compensation coverage. 49 states and the District of Columbia. One state does not require workers' compensation. That's the state of Texas. You can opt in and decide to be covered by workers' compensation, but you're not compelled to do so. What's happening nationally is that there's a trend to opt out. And there's an organization called the Association for Responsible Alternatives to Workers' Compensation. And this is an organization that has been put together by a group of very large national employers who are saying the concept of workers' compensation is perhaps passé. And maybe what we should be allowed to do is put together our own systems for compensating injured workers. These folks have made themselves visible in Oklahoma. Oklahoma, 3 years ago, passed a bill that allowed employers to opt out of workers' compensation.
Would this be like becoming self-insured for workers' comp? Is that
no.
kind of the concept?
Well, I shouldn't say no. It's a lawyer answer, yes and no. How about that?
Oh, perfect.
What it means is the opt-out legislation that was introduced in Oklahoma was legislation that essentially said you no longer have to have workers' compensation if you establish a system within your own business that provides the same kind of benefits, but you design your own structure on how people get benefits. And what invariably happens is that employers design systems that are much more rigid than the state system. Let me give you an example of what happened in Oklahoma. In Oklahoma, in the state of Maine, if you are injured as an employee, you're obligated to give notice of your injury within 30 days of the injury. And sometimes employees don't report injuries right away because something happens at work and they say, oh, I've had this happen 1,000 times before. I bumped my knee. I did this. It'll pass. But then they discover a week later, 10 days later, three or four weeks later that, boy, this is a problem. So they give notice of the injury. In Oklahoma, there's a system that's now being contested in their state Supreme Court where the employer created a notice provision where the employee had to give notice by the end of the work shift, and it had to be in writing. And you can see this same principle, you got to give notice, but what they've done is they've made it so restrictive that it will essentially, I think, limit the number of people who actually have claims. The organization, the Association for Responsible Alternatives, was in Tennessee this past year. My colleagues, or my counterparts, I should say, from South Carolina and from Georgia tell me that they're in those states as well. And I think what they're doing is they're looking at different states who may be favorably disposed to eliminating the obligation to have workers' compensation coverage and opt out for this other system.
So in looking at this as an alternative, is there room for this in the system? In other words, you know, and I know I'm talking to the state about this discussion, right, which your answer, no. But from a practical standpoint, is there room for alternatives out there? Does one size always fit?
Good question. I think, you know, if I believe myself to be open-minded, my answer to your question is yes, there is room. My concern, however, is doing it right. And from what I have seen from the other jurisdictions, they determined legislatively that there was room, but I'm not sure that the systems that they're allowing are good for injured workers, frankly. They're much more tightly written, much more difficult to get benefits, much more restrictive as far as an employee's ability to get appropriate medical treatment and so on. So I think you could possibly do it, but it would have to be very, very carefully done. And my sense is, at least in the state of Maine, not to be trite, but if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I don't think our system is broke.
Somebody once who was an employer mentioned to me says, I don't really understand why we have to have workers' compensation if, in fact, my employees are covered by a medical plan. They're covered by a medical plan,
yeah,
and they have short-term and long-term disability. Why am I paying for a second insurance policy?
Most employers do not provide short- and long-term disability, and with medical plans, there's deductibles and there's co-pays and things like that. If you're injured at work, the theory back in 1915 when Maine adopted our first Workers' Compensation Act, and by the way, we'll celebrate our 100 years next year, 1916. That's when the act took effect, on January 1 of 1916. The theory is employers will be immune from suit. You can't be sued. And instead, employees would be getting workers' compensation benefits, and the benefits would be a reduced weekly payment. It used to be 50% of the employee's average weekly wage. That went through a couple transitions. It's now two-thirds of the employee's average weekly wage. They're entitled to have all directly related medical bills paid without any co-pays, without any deductibles. So it's a better system than your normal health insurance. It's better than normal disability.
So that at least gives an answer in terms of it. When you're looking at the overall trends that are happening nationally, mm-hmm. you talk about that, for example. Are there any looking into whether or not workers' compensation could be held privately rather than having to be done by the state?
No, not that I'm aware of. No, there's no one who's looked at that.
So there isn't any, like, competing. So, again, one of the questions that has come up that I've heard questioning, why isn't there competition in the system in terms of being able to drive down costs and be able, because it's being paid fully by workers' comp,
right.
And sometimes, we all know there's abuse in all systems, sometimes because everything's 100% all the time, everything gets covered, you know, it seems to drive people sometimes, say, from an injury perspective. How do you think about that perspective?
Well, I think there is competition within the system in that you can shop the market for your policies and deal with the different insurance companies that are out there. As I commented earlier, in 1992, I think we were down to either one or two companies.
Yeah.
We presently have over 300 that write insurance in the state of Maine. Some of them have bigger, very large market share. Maine Employers Mutual, for example, has a very large market share. But there are some that may have one or two insureds within the state, and there's others who have licenses to write insurance but are presently not writing insurance. So you can shop the market and find somebody that will give you a good price. The other thing you can do is you can be, if you're fiscally large enough, you can become self-insured. And that's a way to save as well. Or you can join a self-insurance group. And
right.
Some people have found that that's a way to save money. So there are ways to try to control your costs.
Your costs in terms of it.
The other best way to control your costs, frankly, is to get your employees back to work as soon as possible if they're injured. Accommodate them back to work. Take care of them. Facilitate their medical care. One of the issues that I deal with frequently, and I hear from the employee bar, is that the employer is sending their injured workers to doctors that are not the best. I think the good employers send their employees to the best doctor. the theory being the best doctor is going to give the best treatment. The best treatment is going to get people better more quickly, and they're going to get back to work. The focus of our system should be take care of the employee, make sure that they're adequately compensated, make sure that their medical care is taken care of, and that they get back to work as quickly as possible.
No, I think it's absolutely true that in this particular case, I think it's better to err on the side of doing it right. And, you know, I have said for years, and I suspect you'd agree, 99.9% of all employers want to do the right thing. There are very, very few that don't want to have their employees well and come back to work and get them back on the job.
I would wholeheartedly agree
with
that.
I mean, I don't hear anybody saying, oh, I want to do this or that. For the most part, that's what most employers want to do.
Right.
You know, they want that skill back. They need that experience.
Exactly.
They are losing money by having somebody replace that person who doesn't have the same experience and know-how.
Right. I think when I look at the workers' compensation system and I hear employers complain about, you know, the employees staying out too long or the employees doing this or that, and then from the other perspective, I hear employees saying, you know, he's not treating me as well as he should have. He didn't check on how I was doing. Unfortunately, we don't live in a perfect world, and we're dealing with human beings, and we all have our shortcomings, and sometimes shortcomings pop up during the course of the managing of these cases. So,
well, you know, there are, unfortunately or fortunately, you have HR and or legal in terms of this, very cautious on what to say,
mm-hmm.
Fearful of litigation.
That's true.
Right, in terms of a lawsuit. So not saying something or saying something and how you said it and how it was taken out of context or put in writing or on the phone. It is a tricky situation because we are a litigious society and people do sue.
Right. I received one of the parts of my job that I didn't realize I was going to have to deal with until I actually got into the job is that I deal with what might be broadly characterized as constituent inquiries or constituent complaints. I received one yesterday from Congressman Poliquin's office where this gentleman was complaining to him about he wasn't treated properly within the workers' compensation system. The irony is that the gentleman who was complaining has complained to Susan Collins, he's complained to Angus King, complained to Governor LePage, has complained to members of the legislature, and complained to the board. So he has literally exhausted the people to whom he can complain. And the point is, he's had the same complaints over and over. He ended up with a technical problem with his case. I've explained that to him, and he's taken some of my explanations and twisted them in such a way that it looks like I'm now somehow the cause of his problem. So I'll be responding to that inquiry this afternoon. But
well, as we know, people are have their own opinion of what happened.
Yes.
And perception is everything, right? Perception is everything in terms of...
Perception is reality.
In their reality.
Yes.
Right, that's exactly true in terms of what it is. Any other national trends or state trends? How about state trends in terms of it? I know we talked a little bit about some of the things you're working on in projects. Is there anything else in this area? I don't want to exhaust it too much. But
no, things are pretty good in the state. The other big national trend is the trend associated with, and I'm getting back to our original topic, Uber, Lyft, and Sidecar, the new shared economy, and what's going on there. Who's really an employee in an Uber situation? And I don't know if you've ever used Uber, but I have three children, one of whom lives in San Francisco, one of whom lives in Washington, D.C., and one of whom lives in New York City. And when I'm in those places, I've used Uber with my children. I find that it works well. But the question I've always had of these folks who've driven the Uber cars is, who do you work for? Who's your boss? Who do you answer to? Who has control over you? And I'm doing that in part to get my own personal arms wrapped around what's going on here. Who has control? Do they have skin in the game? Do they? If there was a question in this state about them, would they be determined to be an independent contractor or determined to be an employee? In California, for example, the Department of Labor has determined that Uber drivers are employees. In other jurisdictions, there's been questions. There was a case that came up where they tried to make that definitive determination in advance of a full trial. It was through what's called a motion for summary judgment, and the judge said it was too complicated an issue. He would not move on the motion, but rather he set the case ahead for trial. So Uber, Sidecar, but I think that business model is something that we're seeing now in transportation, but we're going to see in a lot of other places as well.
Well, you know, that is interesting. I have read some of that in terms of the decision. I believe it's being appealed in terms of right now, correct,
yes.
In terms of it. That is the new shared economy, isn't it?
It is.
I think it's like anything else. It's a change, a blending of what used to be and what is currently now. Technology has certainly changed everything, right, in terms of the way things are done. It's going to be an interesting answer to that question because I could see both answers to it.
I think the answer is it all depends.
Yeah, and said like a true lawyer. It's great. Well, I want to, you know, take this last few minutes as we're talking today to let you kind of provide to the listeners kind of a recap of the most important things you think that they should remember from today. Okay, in terms of the takeaways, three or four takeaways that you say, if nothing else, Mr. Employer, Mr. and Mrs. HR Professional, make sure you do this.
I think... when an employer has somebody who is injured and they're out of work, I think one of the best things that they can do is keep in contact with their employees. Don't meddle, don't harass them, but simply follow up with them and inquire how you're doing, how are things going, why don't you drop in, geez, we miss you, how are things with the family? Because one of the things I hear over and over from injured workers is they forgot about me, they don't care about me, when in fact there may be tensions that the employer is getting advice that don't meddle with them. They'll think you're trying to harass them. They'll think you're trying to do this. So my advice is to keep in contact with your injured workers. By the same token, I would say to the injured worker community, talk with your employers. Let them know what you're doing. Let them know how you're doing. I think communication is the key within this, within this system. The other thing, too, is I would say to employers, if you have employees, make sure you have workers' compensation coverage, because if we find out that you truly are an employer, you have employees, you run the risk of being penalized for that. The other thing I would say to employers is handle cases correctly. Fill out first reports the way they're supposed to be filled out. Report injuries the way they're supposed to be reported. Fill out wage statements the way they're supposed to be filled out. And treat your employees well. And employees, treat your employers well.
Sound advice. And today we've been talking with Paul Signolfi. He is the Executive Director and Chair of the Workers' Compensation Board. Paul, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.
And now your HR tip of the week. Four reasons to hire people smarter than you. We want employees who have integrity, drive, and brains. If they happen to be smarter than us, all the better. Here's a take on why you should seek out candidates who are brighter than you. 1. Smart people know how to communicate their strengths. 2. Smart people are efficient and proactive. 3. Smart people don't limit themselves to their job descriptions. And 4. Smart people challenge their bosses. That's according to Liz Edling, Co-Chief Executive Officer of TransPerfect in New York. And that's your HR Tip of the Week. Next week on the HR Power Hour, our guest is Giovanni Twigg. He's the Chief HR Officer at IDEX Laboratories. We're going to talk about HR roles in business, why HR needs to have a seat at the table, and what it takes to lean in to make that happen. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.